This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And happy Friday, everyone. And because it's Friday, let's jump right into our week in review, starting with what else? The firing of FBI Director James Comey and response from members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation. In an interview yesterday with NBC News, President Trump justified Comey's firing this way.
He's a showboat. He's a grandstander. The FBI has been in turmoil. You know that. I know that. Everybody knows that.
But here's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who told us this week what she and many of her fellow Democrats believe is the real reason Trump fired Comey.
The reasoning is laughable. The truth is obvious. Donald Trump does not want anyone near him with an investigatory powers about his connection to his campaign and ties to Russia.
And Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton called the Comey firing part of a rapidly escalating crisis.
I think it is a national crisis, and I think it's quickly becoming a constitutional crisis because of the abuses of power that Trump and the executive branch are taking to cover up these crimes. But I don't think that anybody's fooled. You know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And there is so much smoke here, it seems like a massive bonfire.
All right, joining us now to talk about all this and the rest of the week's news, Michael Curry. He's former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP. And Michael, welcome back to Radio Boston. Good to have you.
Glad to be back.
Also with us this week is Jennifer Nasur. She's the former chairwoman of the Massachusetts Republican Party and of counsel to Rubin and Rudman. Jennifer, great to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
So let's dive right into this enormous story that's dominating the news. There have been conflicting statements from the Trump administration about why President Trump decided to fire Comey. A White House statement on Tuesday said that it was the president was acting on the recommendations of the Attorney General Jeff Sessions and Assistant Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. But then President Trump made it clear that, no, he did this because he wanted to and he was going to do it anyway. Michael Curry, let me start with you. What do you make of the firing of James Comey?
Well, I mean, it's troubling. I think you're hearing a chorus of folks, including some Republicans, that feel like this was bad timing. It wasn't a process that made sense. It was disrespectful to Comey and his many years of service. And it really undermines what we all are looking for, which is a process that it can investigate whether Russia had some tampering with maybe some activity by members of the Trump campaign, and that Comey's being there, at least from all perceptions. I mean, he was messing up, if you want to look at it that way, to Republicans and Democrats in terms of how he handled it. He was apolitical in some sense. And folks
you
wanted...
mean he was an equal opportunity messer?
Exactly.
Yeah, gotcha.
So folks wanted this investigation to play out. And what it's been out of the Trump administration is like the bad news bears of politics and governing. Folks aren't on the same page. It's impulsive. It's reactive, and it's concerning for all of us.
Yeah. Jennifer, no, sir, I'd love to get your response as well.
So, you know, it would be interesting if we could go back 6 months and we could change the election outcome and see if it was Hillary Clinton that was elected and what James Comey's fate would have been. I think 6 months ago, Democrats would have said, get rid of him immediately. Now it's the Republicans getting rid of him. So I think if you look on it, at it, you know, on a fair basis of he's an equal opportunity pain in the butt, right, then everyone wanted to get rid of him. I think the biggest problem for the Trump administration is this. Number one, no one's on the same page. He let his senior staffers know an hour before it happened. Sean Spicer didn't even know. He didn't have time to prepare for this. He had a staff meeting behind a bunch of hedges and came out to a bunch of press standing
there. This
is
Sean Spicer, I mean, who literally said, turn off the lights, I'll talk to you, but not on TV.
Yeah. Right. I mean, so he was caught basically, you know, with his pants down. Not literally, but I mean, he's behind the hedges and he this is the information he has. So I think that, you know, the optics of this, the appearance of it, the timing, Trump is not masterful at any of that. And I think we are very used to our leaders being masterful, being very methodical, and Trump lacks the capacity to be methodical.
Well, let's listen to a little bit from a conversation we had this week with Senator Elizabeth Warren, a little more of that. We heard her in the opening of this segment. But here's what she said about calling for that this raises the need for a special prosecutor. Here's a little bit of what she said.
We must have a special prosecutor here. And we've got to have someone who is independent, who has got the resources, who has got the authority to get to the bottom of this. good, bad, or indifferent, whatever is the truth here, we need a special prosecutor to get the truth out there. And everyone should care about that.
So, Jennifer, I want to come back to you to respond to Senator Warren, because, I mean, a moment ago you were talking about confusion and sort of what amounts to bad optics. And I take your point there. Senator Warren is talking about something, and a lot of the Democrats, a lot more serious, right? She's talking about this was an effort to derail an investigation that was getting too close to the president. Do you buy that?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think Trump had his issues with Comey. I think, again, both parties had their issues with Comey. I think Comey's head was on the chopping block going back to September, October. And it didn't matter who was going to be the president. So I think past that, though, yes, a special investigator should be appointed. There should be someone else. I don't think anyone disagrees with that. I mean, maybe I don't know if, you know, the president, I'm not on the phone with him. But I mean, I think Republicans agree that a special prosecutor should be in place here.
Although, Michael Curry, not very many Republicans in Washington yet agree with that. Do you think they're going to get there, given the turmoil that's coming out of that?
I think they have no choice. I think, you know, what we've been seeing play out, it plays out in politics in general sometimes, but you'll see what I call politicrits, right, is that the notion that it doesn't apply that now the shoe's on the other foot. The reality is that they would have called for a special prosecutor if this were a Democrat and there were the same circumstances. I think it'll eventually play out that there's a lack of trust in this administration. There's no truth coming out of this administration. It's lots of spin. And they're going to say, you know what, it is in the best interest of the country that we ask for a special prosecutor. I think, you know, people and I've hung out with, and I know the Boston FBI very well. When you get to the rank and file FBI agents, I think people will try to do the right thing. But we know how politics works. Politics can sometimes have a chilling effect on how people do the right thing. Mm. And the fervor, the forcefulness with which they conduct an investigation. So I think a special prosecutor is necessary, and I think we will eventually get a consensus among Democrats and Republicans to get there.
You know, all of this happens with a pretty ambitious agenda in Washington on the part of Republicans in Congress. They're talking about tax reform. Of course, there's the effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. I'd love to ask you both. Jennifer, I'll start with you. I mean, what does this do, this turmoil that we're seeing right now, to essentially the work of the people and the agenda in Congress?
So first of all, let's go back to 2010. There's been turmoil in Congress since, you know, there has been a seismic shift in the parties, where the Republicans have had this big pull to the right from the Tea Party back then, and the Democrats have had this big pull to the left. And I think the more that we are romanticizing the fact of people getting on TV and fighting and arguing, and of course, like, if I take Michael in a headlock and I slam him down to the ground,
and I believe you could do that,
your ratings are going to be amazing, right?
But I wouldn't let it happen, Michael. That's my job.
But
here,
I mean, you know, he seems like a nice guy, yeah. And so you know, we have friends in common, and that's not going to happen. And so, unfortunately, you know, the theatrics of politics has really moved the country, and yeah, it's very unfortunate, because I think that it is not something that just happened in 2017 with this Congress and this administration. It is something that has been brewing for a while.
Yeah. Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we're a divided country and we're a divided Congress, right? And quite frankly, I'm troubled by where we are. I think most of us who turn on the television, and many of us don't turn on the television and watch the news anymore, because it creates this anxiety. We need to move some things forward. We need a transportation infrastructure bill that will put people to work and create, you know, fix roads and bridges. We need, we may disagree on what tax changes we need, but there may be some need to look at what those are. And quite frankly, there's a ideological difference that's between the parties, but within the party. When I say the party, I'm talking about the Republican Party, the far right, who believe that we should not have Medicaid expansion, that we should get government out of health care. And then you have some moderate Republicans like Collins, who believes that there's a role that we play to make
Susan
sure that
Collins, Susan Maine, Collins, right, yeah,
to make sure that people are covered. So I think that what we're seeing is we're in a bottleneck where we can't get anything done because there's such an ideological divide in the nation and down in D.C.
And, you know, that is absolutely such an amazing point, Michael, because I've had this conversation with members of Congress because it really boggles my mind. I mean, the Republican Party right now, I mean, the Democrats have their own issues. But speaking from the Republican perspective, we are so spread out over different levels. Why a tax reform bill would bring the party together, and it would get us a lot of the moderate Democrats that want to move some good policy forward. Infrastructure, everyone agrees with it. I mean, this gets people back to work. It puts money into the economy. Who doesn't love that? And they just keep getting bogged down in the weeds on these other matters that are just causing more friction.
And just to add to that, I think Trump is so impulsive. I mean, I would really love to take a poll of Republicans off air, just sit down and talk to them, because I think even if you voted for him, you can tell that he's impulsive, he's not consistent, and quite frankly, he brings that sort of real estate shadiness to governing. And I think that's the best way to describe it, which is basically it's not about the truth, it's about winning. And it's about influencing the outcome by any means necessary. That should trouble us all as Americans. And I quite frankly am troubled every time I turn on the television and listen to him or watch a tweet.
Well, speaking of the legislative agenda, and you both made reference to, or I guess you did, Michael, to health care. I want to talk about what happened on Sunday. President Obama was in Boston to receive the Profile in Courage Award from the Kennedy family, and he used his speech at the Kennedy Library to really sort of weigh back into the political fray, really for the first time since leaving office. He defended the Affordable Care Act, said it took courage for lawmakers to pass it back in 2009, and encouraged lawmakers today to show a bit of courage of their own. Here's a bit of what he said.
I hope that current members of Congress recall that it actually doesn't take a lot of courage to aid those who are already powerful, already comfortable, already influential, but it does require some courage to champion the vulnerable and the sick and the infirm.
Michael, I'll start with you on this one. You know, President Obama is still very careful. He didn't mention Trump by name. He wasn't really sort of in full campaign mode. But there he was taking a stand on a big issue in Washington. What did you think of the president sort of weighing back in to the political debate?
I'm a fan of President Obama's, and I wish he had come out sooner. But I appreciate that he took some time away for he and his family. We need his voice. I think, quite frankly, the misrepresentation of the ACA. The ACA is not perfect. Like any other major piece of legislation, whether it's state or federal, it has flaws. It needs to be fixed. But the reality is millions of Americans, and I will say this as an NAACP-er, many of them people of color, went from going to the ER to get their primary care to having a primary care doctor, to diagnosing that diabetes and that cancer sooner in order to have a chance to live and live longer and raise a family. So he needs to tell that story, because I think people get bogged down in whether the ACA is good, which the polls say, but the Obamacare is bad, when they're really the same thing. He needs to come out and say, you know what, this was a good piece of legislation that needs to be fixed. But quite frankly, we have a party that's really running a campaign against something that is good for people, good for America.
Yeah. Jennifer, I mean, I guess one of the things that the president is contending with is this belief in the important principle that there's only one president at a time. So it seems like he's moving carefully back into this debate, still not mentioning Trump by name, not wanting to get his hands too dirty in it. What did you see on Sunday?
I mean, not surprised that he mentioned it. He brought it up. This is his signature piece of legislation. And of course, this is his baby. So he's going to be a little bit more protective over this. I don't know how much it matters, because Republicans, if we go back to 2010 when Scott Brown was elected, he was elected in Massachusetts off of being the 41st vote in the Senate against Obamacare. And so I don't know how much the president weighing in at this point is going to do, because Republicans have spent the past 7 years talking about repealing Obamacare. Now they're saying repeal and replace. The House left, you know, this baby or this monster on the doorstep of the Senate. The U.S. Senate now has to go back and take care of it and figure out some other process. And I think it's going to be interesting to see whether both houses can come to a compromise. But I'm not surprised that the president is trying to weigh in on this.
Well, let's move on to another story. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was not only in the news this week for his role in the Jim Comey story. He's also issued new guidelines to federal prosecutors across the country today, telling them to pursue the toughest possible charges and sentences against crime suspects. Now, Sessions spoke this morning to the NYPD Sergeants Benevolent Association. Here's a bit of what he said.
Going forward, I have empowered our prosecutors to charge and pursue the most serious offense, as I believe the law requires, most serious, readily provable offense. It means that we're going to meet our responsibility to enforce the law with judgment and fairness. It is simply the right and moral thing to do.
Okay, so here's another point of view. WBUR spoke with Donald Stern today. He served as the U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts back in 1993 to 2001, and he had some issues with Sessions' guidelines. Here's what he said.
Well, I think it's a mistake. I mean, this is to some extent a harking back to an earlier regime of enforcement. I think one of the things we've learned, particularly as crime rates have come down, is that we need to afford some discretion to the prosecutors on the front end to make some distinction between very serious violent offenders, which deserve, in many cases, long prison sentences, and those that don't.
So, Jennifer, I'll start with you here. I mean, one of the pieces of the platform that Trump ran on was to be a tough law enforcement president. Is he just doing what he said he would do?
Absolutely. Again, it's, you know, something that Trump ran on, and he's fulfilling his promise. If you are a diehard Trump supporter, you are thrilled with these actions. You're thrilled with health care. You're thrilled with what Sessions is saying. I would say, though, at the end of the day, you know, maybe Sessions needs to come to Massachusetts and talk to the folks over at Mass Inc. and talk about criminal justice reform and see what the statistics really are. Right. In Massachusetts, we're paying over $50,000 per inmate, and they come out and they commit the same offenses again. So, it's interesting to see and to hear about, but I don't know in practicality if it's a very good measure.
Right. Michael Curry, I imagine you would have concerns about the implications of a policy like this in a state like Massachusetts.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked on campaigns against mandatory minimums and really championed this issue as an NAACP around criminal justice reform. I was encouraged over the last 2-3 years when you had Democrats and Republicans starting to understand that mass incarceration is real and it wasn't a good thing, and that there are too many people incarcerated for nonviolent offenses. The concern I have, and actually the interesting thing, is that there's a survey that came out recently that showed that Trump supporters actually want criminal justice reform, too. And they tied it to the opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. Because if you're dealing with the white rural families whose children are now getting caught up in this opioid crisis, they don't want their children to go to jail. They want them to get services and treatment. So maybe there's a way to penetrate this sort of Trump support to really push him and have his supporters hold him accountable to do this smart. Session is dangerous because he would feed mass incarceration because he has a no-nonsense, high incarceration approach to this work. It's not smart on crime, and that's a concern for all of us.
Well, you mentioned the opioid addiction crisis, and this week the Department of Health announced that opioid deaths in Massachusetts reached a pretty grim milestone. They're projected that more than 2,000 people died of opioid-related overdoses in Massachusetts in 2016 alone. Now, that's a record number, roughly equivalent to 6 people dying in the state every day of opioid-related overdoses. So here's Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters talking about these numbers.
The fact that the absolute number would appear to be just over 2,000 in 2016 is a sobering reminder that we still have a lot more work to do to bend the trend of opioid death.
Now, our reporter Martha Biebinger reminded me that there's some good news in this, in that the rate of increase is actually slowing. Still, Jennifer and Sir, these are still pretty sobering numbers, and as Mary Lou Sutter suggested, still lots of work left to do on this.
Absolutely. And I think Governor Baker has been doing an amazing job getting ahead of this and putting together the groups of people that he has put together to research this and to move forward on this and to really try to clean up Massachusetts. And, you know, the secretary is a fabulous example of what he's doing out there.
Speaking of Governor Baker, Michael Curry, President Trump put him on a commission, an opioid, essentially a federal commission to study the opioid addiction crisis nationally. What does that say about the sort of the way Massachusetts is dealing with this and what more Massachusetts needs to do?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to be in a meeting with the governor earlier this week, and it was on a host of issues around health centers and the substance abuse or substance use disorder and what he's doing. He appropriately has the title of the opioid governor, as awkward as that sounds, mm-hmm. and he embraces that. It's because he understands that there's an impact on families, and people need the services, and providers need the tools to be able to treat and save lives. So I think we're in a good position as a state, and I think this is another example of us leading and leading from the front and not leading from behind. So I'm excited about the fact that he's placed in that position. And quite frankly, because of the way Massachusetts voted and the positions he's taken on immigration and on Affordable Care Act, we need him to have some wins with this administration, too, so that he has some relationships. He can bring back some good policy and good success for the state of Massachusetts.
What do you think? I know this is a pretty tough question because this is such a vexing crisis, the opioid addiction crisis. But what more does a state like Massachusetts need to do to sort of further bend that rate of increase in deaths down?
Well, you know, it's funny. It goes back to, I mean, I grew up in Roxbury, right, in an age where people didn't have the tolerance for the crack addiction. And my sister was a crack addict. I remember people treated her like she was a criminal, and treated people who in substance use like they were criminals. So I think one is you got to get to the underlying issues that lead to substance use disorder. And I think now, and I hate to say this on a racial sense, but now that more white kids and white families are impacted, now we can have a conversation that will lead to the preemptive, the prevention services that will save lives and keep people from going down that path. And then you got to put your money where your mouth is. You got to invest in the services that will treat these people when they come into the ERs or a health center or whatever.
All right. Jennifer, sort of final thought for you on where we go in terms of fighting this opioid addiction crisis.
You know, I don't know if it was that it's that more white kids are involved in it. I think the thing is the white communities were just very quiet about it because when it happened, it was your kid is, you know, you're at this upper echelon and that was who got it. And now it's everyone can get it. And so they were able to hide it. I think that it takes families who are involved in it. It takes the schools that are involved in it. It is really a village who needs to be watching our kids and make sure that they're on the right path to success and that they're busy enough. If our young kids are
Absolutely.
Busy and they are involved in sports and they have good friends, chances that they're going to get involved in drugs and get addicted is so much smaller than if we just let them run around the streets and have lots of time available to them.
All right. Finally, I want to leave a little bit of time for our hubbubs, those brief stories that caught our attention but might have fallen below the fold this week. Michael, let me come to you first. What's your hubbub?
Probably the hubbub for me, and I think it's some of the reaction to what happened at the Red Sox, and not the main story, but really the outflow of conversation about where we are as a city. It's created some conversation about Boston's history, but about where we are now. And I think that, to me, that's a long overdue conversation. Is Boston having a conversation with Boston? And I think that the outcome of that will be good.
All right. And of course, you're talking about the story about 10 days ago or so when fans threw peanuts and hurled racial insults to a Baltimore
Absolutely.
Orioles player. Yeah, right. A lot of interesting conversation about that. Jennifer Nasser, your hubbub.
Mine is a little bit more on topic for what we were talking about today in incarceration. Mass Inc. came out with a report this week, and they came out with a poll on where people in Massachusetts believe that the criminal justice area should go. And Mass Inc. is having a criminal justice reform summit on Monday morning. And there are over 350 people coming into that. So hopefully they will continue to push out some good information
Absolutely.
And be able to make some serious impact in Massachusetts.
All right. So here's my hubbub, and it sort of takes us in a slightly different direction. Today, the Social Security Administration released its annual list of the top 1,000 baby names for 2016. Now, for a third year in a row, the most popular female name is Emma, followed by Olivia, Ava, Sophia, and Isabella, which makes me think we're sort of embracing 19th century sounding names. For boys, the top name was Noah for the fourth year in a row, followed by Liam, William, Mason, and James. And the name that dropped in popularity the most for some reason, Caitlin, which fell out of the top 1,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Like there's some
name.
Theories as to why that's happening, but I don't want to get into that. Now, for what it's worth, I put my name into their little calculator. Anthony peaked in 2007 and 2008, when it was the seventh most popular name. In 2006, it had fallen to number 30. Michael, your name had a spectacular run from 1954 to 1998. It was number one.
Wow. Right? I didn't
That's
even know
44
that.
Years. Today, you're at number eight.
Okay.
Okay. Jennifer, your name was number one from... No, this is good.
This is going to date me.
From 1970 to 1984, today you are 273, the 273rd most popular name.
Yeah,
all right. Anyway, but still a lot better than Caitlin. Okay. Michael Curry, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP. Michael, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And Jennifer Nasur, a former chairwoman of the Massachusetts Republican Party and of counsel to Rubin and Rudman. Jennifer, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.